SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 88 with guest Angela Henry. Our guest today is Angela Henry. Angela is a principal consultant at Fortified and a Microsoft Data Platform MVP who describes herself as a data mover and shaper on LinkedIn. Angela has a particular fondness for the Microsoft BI stack and Databricks, and you'll find her online at SQL Swimmer. So welcome, Angela.
Thanks, Greg. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's awesome. Hey, before I get you to tell us anything else, so what's with SQL Swimmer?
I am a swimmer, and more than that, I also am a coach. So I coach swim team for both little kids and adults, and then I also teach swim lessons for both little kids and adults. And I am an admin official for USA Swimming in the United States.
Very good. How's the weather there for swimming? I'm in Melbourne now, and swimming's a lot of people swim, but I mean it's not like when I grew up in Brisbane and like everybody swims all the time.
Yeah. We're just coming out of winter, and it wasn't like a particularly cold winter, but it was very rainy. And I find that the older I get, the less I like being cold and wet.
Yeah. that's not really surprising.
Yeah. But most of the pools around here, they have outdoor pools, but they also have indoor pools as well. And I actually coach for a club with an indoor pool. And then in the summer, they have an outdoor pool that they use. So they have both. For the most part here in where I live in North Carolina, not a whole lot of people swim outdoors in the winter.
That's exactly what I was wondering.
No, too cold.
Actually, the strange thing when I was growing up in Queensland is that one of the things we're always fighting against is not losing tourists. So we get tourists who come from all over the world, many of whom have never swum before or terribly much. And then they go into the ocean and they get into, serious rips and things and so on. And not good.
Not good. No, definitely.
And, definitely not good. We have this thing where we like the tourists to go home again, and be happy. Yeah.
That would be nice.
Actually, it's quite funny. Some particular countries. I remember the first time seeing them on the beach at like Surfers Paradise, and you could tell they were the one in the suit. And you just think, huh, interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, like a three-piece suit. But anyway, so listen, tell us about your role and how'd you get involved with SQL Server at all?
Okay. So way back when I graduated from college, I've got a degree in math with a minor in computer science, and I actually just kind of fell into a job out of college, like literally. So I was sharing a house with a few other women. We're all roommates, and one day one of them came home and said, "Hey, Angela, do you play softball?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I can play softball." And she says, "Great, my company has this co-ed rec league that they belong to, and we need more women on our team. So will you come and play softball with us?" And I said, "Okay, sure. I don't have anything else to do on Saturday morning, so fine, I'll do that." So I played, and I was still in school, so I played softball with these people for probably about a year. I didn't know what they did. they knew that I was a student. That was it. The pitcher was terrible. I used to make fun of him because he was just a horrible pitcher. All that. And then one day we were all sitting around and talking about stuff and somebody posed a technical question and I answered it without even thinking. And they all just like simultaneously turned and looked at me and they're like, how do you know that? And I said, well, yeah, that's kind of what I do. And they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, when do you graduate? And I was like, in 2 months. They're like, do you want a job? And I was like, okay.
So, that's good. There you go. The softball connection.
I was like, oh awesome. My gosh. Yeah. So I went to work for them and I started out as a programmer, you know, Visual Basic. Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing. The fancy things that we did was screen scraping from mainframes. That was huge technology then. And I enjoyed it. But then I got working on a larger project and my mentor also did database work and I was a programmer. I didn't know anything about databases other than, you know, they made my life miserable as a programmer. But once I kind of, you know, got under his tutelage and he kind of showed me some stuff, I was like, oh yeah, this is what it's all about.
There you go.
Yeah. And I never looked back. I started taking classes. And it was, you know, at that point it was really hard because Google wasn't even a thing yet. So trying to learn SQL Server, that long ago was a challenge. So, you know, you ended up doing things like,
that's right. There was official courseware and there was documentation and classes in various spots. Actually, one of the things that I've often said in terms of the number of women in the industry is that we used to run code camps and we would get 300 or 400 people along to a developer code camp, but it would be 5 to 10% women. But when we ran data ones, we would get 40% women arriving. And so it was I thought it was a real sweet spot for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, and I absolutely loved it. And I just, I thrived and that's what I absolutely loved to do. And it, you know, and I never looked back. And then about, so I was a DBA for about 15 years. And then about 15 years ago, I said, you know what? I'm tired of doing the same old thing every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed the writing code, you know, and creating something. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to switch over to the BI side of the house and start doing that kind of stuff and building data warehouses and, and, you know, and in, you know, 2005 when integration services came out, I was like, oh, I was just mesmerized. I thought it was amazing. So yeah. And then I just kind of never really looked back and have just gone with the flow and, you know, learned everything I could about analysis services and reporting services and integration services. And, you know, and then the cloud came along and we have all these other new things that we have to learn about. But the one thing that I saw, you know, as a DBA was, you know, you always have to tune things because people always complain it's slow. And then you go in and you look at stuff and you look at the query plans and you look at all of this stuff and you realize that people abuse data types.
Yes. And so that's actually the thing that I was, we were talking about discussing today.
Yeah.
It's actually a pet topic of mine as well. And so I'll be fascinated to hear what you have to say with it because a large part of what you're doing in most BI projects, for example, is, well, they would say wrangling data and just endlessly. It's the transform. It's the thing that actually has me quite puzzled at the moment is that I saw Bob Duffy commenting the other day that they keep talking about like the new versions of mirroring and so on. And they're saying, it removes all your ETL. And we just think, no, you know, it does the, you know, let's get the data over to here. But most of the work is actually putting the data in the right shape to make it usable.
Exactly. Yeah. So
So with SQL Server data types.
Yeah.
So what are the things that you think people most don't understand?
They don't understand the implication that if you actually use the wrong data type, you can get the wrong answer.
Totally.
And that is, you know, who cares how fast it comes back? If you got the wrong answer, mm-hmm. it's still the wrong answer. And that's what a lot of people don't really understand. They think that, oh, well, yeah, it does that, you know, conversion for me. So it doesn't matter. I can do that. And I'm like, no, not really. So that's the, I think that's the biggest pitfall that people fall into, is they don't realize they can actually get the wrong answer.
Hmm. And so with the integer types, mm-hmm. anything, or the numeric types, I suppose we'll start there. Anything that is, I think the only thing I always think is a little odd is that tiny ints can't be negative.
Yeah.
That's one that sort of throws people a little, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes, because they think, oh, yeah, I can go down to a tiny int. And you think, yeah, well, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually, let's talk about bits.
Okay.
Because it's interesting, Davide, who's now in the product group,
yes.
but again, was an MVP for a long time. Mm-hmm. I sent him a thing yesterday, again, where I just sort of discussing, I really wish we had an actual Boolean data type. I don't know if you have a feeling on that or not.
You know, it kind of goes, part of me, you know, that old programmer person that I used to be, it would make things a whole lot easier for front-end development.
Yeah.
But
it's just, yeah, a bit, people say, yeah, I want a Boolean. People say, oh, there's bits. And I go, yeah, no, but they're not a Boolean, right?
No.
And then, and other languages like Postgres and stuff do have a Boolean data type. Yeah. And I think it's sort of interesting. I mean, you know, the simple test is if you have to say, if you can't just go if this, you have to go if this equals something, then this is not a Boolean type, you know, and
that is
unless
true.
It's true or false, the thing you're comparing it to, which again, we don't have a concept of a true or false Mm-mm. in the language.
No, we don't.
And so, yeah, bit, I think the other thing with bit is just the fact that, people often are not used to the fact that that's nullable as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that there's three possible states that a bit can be in. Yeah. And so are there things around nullability that you find people don't get?
Yeah. I still, to this day, I see people using the equal operator on it, equal null.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't work. No wonder mm-hmm. your query's not giving you the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah, so simple example, we say where column equals null,
yeah.
and that's just not going to work.
No.
And I suppose the most common place that I see people fall into that is they often don't write that, but they'll have a parameter or a variable or something that is null, and then they will compare some column to that variable or parameter or something and not think about the fact that it could be null.
Exactly. Yeah, that I've seen that many times where you're, you know, they'll come to you and say, but it worked when I tested it. Well, did you test all possible scenarios? Because
right.
I'm thinking not.
It's actually one of my favorite things that has been added to the language in recent times was is distinct from and is not distinct from. And that's, of course, there's been an ANSI solution to that for a very, very long time, and one that we didn't have.
Yeah.
And so I was super, super happy to see them add it. What I would have liked with that, though, is a synonym operator.
Mm.
You know, like in we've had now for a while, you know, plus equals, and
mm-hmm.
we've had the things like the greater than, less than for left shift, right shift, all those sort mm-hmm. of things. The thing I find a hassle with is distinct from is that we nearly always use it in the not case.
Yeah.
So we end up saying is not distinct from, because what you're really wanting to say is are these two things equivalent?
Yeah.
And boy, that's pretty wordy when you have that. Mind you, it's a lot less wordy than saying, yeah, where these things are null or, you know, that is null and that is null,
yes.
you know, and so on and so on. I mean, it's way better than that.
Yes.
But I really wish we had like maybe the double equals sign to have like an equivalence
mm-hmm.
where you could say where this column double equals some variable or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
Anyway, I'm trying to convince him of that, so we'll see. But yeah, that was a really, really good thing. And so, yeah, I think nullability is a big one.
It is. It is. And, you know, even I'm still shocked to this day at how many developers don't really understand that. And how to code around it or code with it or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I am still shocked to this
day. Do you see a lot that decide they don't want to and they just make a decision that no column in the database will be nullable?
And well, you know, and coming from the BI world, that's what you want. You don't want things to be null. And you want to be, you know, you provide sentinel values for things when it's, you know, if it's null, then we pick a value and we say it's NA or it's unknown or something so that we don't have those null values. But yeah.
And of course, the thing they do often in transactional databases is people will pick a magic value. And so it'll be this value when it's stored means there isn't a value.
Yes.
the problem with that logic is that everything that touches that has to know that rule.
Exactly.
And that never happens. You know, I mean, you know that value is going to leak out onto a screen somewhere or something.
It absolutely is. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I encourage people, don't use magic values. You know, don't store something that means something else.
No.
Please don't do that. But yeah, I saw one the other day, actually, is that they, in all their string columns, they would put a single tab in there rather than having it null.
Oh
yeah. It's the thing I love about doing consulting and mentoring work is you can't make this stuff up, right?
That is so true.
It never have dawned on me.
I was just looking at something today from a client where they created a column that will store, it's two characters. That's all it will ever be, two characters. And they made it a varchar 500. And I'm like,
just in case.
And I'm like, but it's never going to be more than two. And how many rows are in that table? Over a billion? Okay. You know, I mean, it's because it's
actually
varchar.
Strings are a challenge,
yeah.
Right? And so a lot of people look forlornly across the fence at Postgres and things where there's just a string data type and think, gee, it'd be nice if we just had something like that.
Well, isn't that what varchar max is? It's just a string, right?
Sort of, yeah, indeed. Although their one out of the box can be UTF-8, and yeah, ours is different to that, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I had.
And have you been making use? Oh, I suppose we should start with, yeah. So we have the char and varchar options that are single, well, previously all single byte things. And then we've got nvarchar, which was
the double wide.
The funky, yeah, double. Well, yeah, although from 2012, it was possible to have surrogate pairs where you could have 4-byte characters as well, but they were pretty uncommon. Most people would make the assumption that a varchar is nvarchar is 2 characters or an nchar. But yeah, it's where it becomes interesting, of course, is you're getting the length of that. So length returns the length of the string, sort of.
Yeah.
But data length returns the size of the string, right? And so have you come across areas where length doesn't play the way you'd hope?
Well, when it's used by developers who don't understand the difference between length and data length, yeah.
So. Yeah, indeed. Well, another one is that in a lot of these cases where it... the length doesn't include things like trailing spaces and so on. And then you go, oh, you know, like I'm not comfortable with that. You know, like I if I have trailing spaces to me, that's part of the stream.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. I see that a lot. I've had a lot of insurance clients, and they have a lot of, like, with policy numbers, they will actually put, like, trailing spaces on things. So they are super important, and you don't want that trimmed off. It has to be counted because
that's right.
It's part of the value. So, yeah.
Plus they might do things like concatenating that value with something else, and then the fact that it's not there.
Yes.
Actually ends up changing the value.
It does. And in fact, that's actually what, so there are three major players in the insurance industry as far as software in the United States. And that's exactly what they do in one of those systems is they use that combined with three other fields concatenated together to produce a unique value for, you know, the client. And when you don't know that you're trimming that off, that becomes a problem.
Yeah. You'd hope they, if they were doing that, they might use a delimiter or something. But yeah, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we've got the UTF-8 stuff, which I must admit I was really, really, really looking forward to. But I'm actually really disappointed in how it was done. I don't know if you have any thoughts on it or not.
You know, I don't. And mostly because it's not come up in any of the clients that I work with. It's not been an issue for them. Most of my clients are US-based, and UTF-8 is just not something that...
Yeah, it's not a thing for them yet. Actually, even for US-based things, it can often end up, unless they're using Voucher all the time, it could end up actually making things smaller anyway, potentially. So, the thing that I don't love with the UTF-8 implementation is that if I said I want Voucher 10, if you ask almost any developer doing work with a database, they would tell you that means 10 characters, right? But in SQL Server, if I say varchar 10 and I'm using UTF-8, that means I can store somewhere between 2 and 10 characters in that string. And I'm not comfortable with that, right? Because they say the 10 is not the number of characters, it's the number of bytes.
Oh.
And I go, okay. And so because a character can then be 1, 2, 3, or 4 bytes long.
Yeah.
Then varchar, now, I can't see any place where that is sensible and usable.
No. I would agree with that.
Right? And so I look at Postgres, and Postgres, you go varchar 10, it goes, that's 10 characters.
Yeah.
and that is precisely how I would expect it should work.
Yeah.
And then they pointed out that in... Of course, in nvarchar, the number in brackets is not bytes there. Of course, it's byte pairs.
Yes.
And you go, right. Okay. But what a lot of people don't realize is since 2012, there are characters that have 2 byte pairs. So even an nvarchar 10 doesn't mean you can put 10 characters in there.
No.
It means somewhere between 5 and 10 characters could fit in there. And you're like, okay. But I look at that and go, if you're going to have a number in brackets like that, I can't imagine why any developer would have any interest at all in it, limiting it by the number of bytes and not the number of characters.
No, No, because they don't care about the bytes. I mean, they don't.
I just wish they'd fix that. And now that it's in there, I'm not sure how it gets fixed, except maybe if they could add another thing, you know, you go varchar 10 characters or something that might help it. But anyway, yeah, I just think the UTF-8 implementation is, shall we say, not like I'd like it to be.
Yeah. That's good to know because, like I said, being US-based and most of my clients are US-based, I haven't had to dig into that and look at it at all. So that's very interesting. Hmm. And, of course, now I'm going to go play with it as soon as we're done with this call. So
there you go. And okay, so and then what about things with decimal points in them? What do you strike there? Because of course that's always a world of fun.
Yeah. So, another thing that I just saw today, along with those people who stored two characters in a varchar 255, is they are using the float data type. And it just made my skin crawl.
Yes.
And because, and the reason is because these are readings from IoT devices where the preciseness is super, super important.
Yeah.
And they're using float data types, which are not always super, super precise. So it made me a little nervous to see that that's how they had designed this. And I was like, maybe we should change that.
I actually have a blog post saying that I think float is the number one newbie mistake with SQL Server is that, look, I work on systems where I expect the numbers to add up.
Yeah.
Most
people do.
And it's a discussion I've endlessly had with the Power BI team because the thing that I don't like there is they've actually made it doubly worse because they call it decimal, but it's actually a float. So then they've really boxed themselves into a corner with, if we actually wanted to add a decimal, what do we do?
Yeah.
You know, another data type, yeah, a real decimal.
Yeah. Not that fake decimal over there, but the real one.
Yeah, and see, like, so if you use the currency in Power BI, mm-hmm. then it actually stores it accurately because it stores it as an integer internally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the numbers add up. But I work on lots of systems where there are things like lengths and, you know, all these sorts of things, and the customers actually expect the numbers to add up. And
that's just crazy talk.
And in Power BI, they don't.
No. Yeah, that might be.
And so,
important.
Yeah, it's a case of understanding, yeah, that it is an approximate value. And so, kind of, I think what people don't get is that we take numbers like a third in decimal and we go 0. Well, lots of threes until we get bored.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it happens in binary as well, just at different places. And so the reality is, in float, you can't actually store 10 cents, you know, like 0.1. You can store something very close to 10 cents, but it's not 10 cents.
It's not, you know? 10 cents.
And so do you tend to use float at all?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, that's what I suspected.
Mm-hmm. No, I'll use a decimal and choose the precision appropriate for the data domain that I'm working with.
Yep.
So, you know, I've got some manufacturing clients where, you know, when you're talking about converting to standard unit of measure and all that kind of thing, you know, you typically are going to take it out to 4 or 6 decimal points so that you can make sure that you're getting the most accurate conversion in there. And so that's what I do is and that's my big deal is, you know, when I do talk to folks about data types, my point is not to always like use the smallest because it's going to save you the most space. My point has always been use what is appropriate for your data domain. You need to understand your data and how it's going to be used so that you can make the correct, you know, the appropriate decision on what data type to use. And that's always been my like big takeaway is like, if you get nothing else out of this class, just understand your data and how it's going to be used.
Hmm. Actually, it's interesting. I was responding to a guy commenting on a blog post this morning and he was struggling with the decimal data type. And then when I looked at his code, it was because every value was decimal 38.18.
Oh.
And you just think, oh my. Okay.
That's a really big number with a lot of decimals.
People have no concept how large that is. Yeah. that is a seriously large number.
Yeah.
And it's something that people don't get even with integers. You know, I see people who want to, you know, they're worried about running out of 64-bit integers. And I just go, really? You know, like, Yeah, I saw a thing in the early 90s where they said, you know, if you got an 8-bit computer and you got 256 values, you put it in a loop adding one, you know, it's a blink of an eye that it would overflow. And in a 16-bit one with 65,000 values, again, blink of an eye, you know. With 32-bit, you know, when you're up to 4,000 million, some systems you might perceive how long that would be, but they were saying for 64-bit on the fastest machine available that day, it was about 350 years of just adding one in a tight loop before it got to the biggest value. Now, machines are much faster since then.
Sure.
But, you know, let's be serious about how big that number is.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah.
And so I see it's one of the things people argue. They say, oh, I've got 64. You know, I changed all the values to goods because I'm worried about running out of ints. And you go, yeah, really?
Think of all that wasted storage. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, I mean, you get an int, a GUIDS, basically, a 128-bit integer. I mean, so if 64-bit is bigger than you can comprehend, you know, 128 is out of all concepts of time and reality, you know, as to how big it is.
But, yeah.
I mean, there are use cases for it. Do you use GUIDS much at all?
I try not to because we have big ints now. So I don't. The only places that I would use GUIDS is, you know, where we're just looking for something unique that's not a number. And it's not anything that's going to be, you know, clustered or anything like that, because that's just a nightmare in and of itself. So I very rarely do I use GUIDS unless I have a really good use case for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting. To me, the reason for using GUIDS when you do is that you've got layers of code outside the database that need to generate values that are unique.
Mm-hmm.
That they can throw into the database and not worry about colliding with something that comes from somewhere else, right? And so in that case, I'm comfortable with that. I'm also don't always believe that your logical and physical models end up the same in the database either. And so the fact that you've got GUIDS all over the place doesn't mean you have to have them on every table and that has to be part of every join, right?
Yeah.
You know, there are ways I could map values, for example, and get around that sort of thing. And so that's okay. And so, of course, the team then added new sequential GUID. And again, I've got a blog post about that one where I think it just totally misses the mark, right?
Yeah.
The only way you can use it is as a database default value. And I think if you're going to the database to get a default value, why get a GUID?
Yeah.
Like, you just get an integer. Like, I mean, the whole thing with a GUID is to avoid having a central number issuer.
Yes.
And if you're going to have a central number issuer, then
make it a
why
number.
Make it a GUID?
Make it a number.
Number. Yeah. And so, yeah, I just thought they just completely missed the mark, that one. Nice try, but yep, no. don't love it. The other data types that are in there, and so, I mean, we've had, I suppose, XML in detail now since 2005.
Yeah.
Do you tend to use anything much there?
I did back in the when it first came out, because everybody wanted to store XML. Then, of course, you had to learn to write, you know, link for XML so that you could pull your stuff out and all that kind of stuff. And that was just a pain. And then you had to, kind of brings back, you know, like PTSD of having to pull out all of these XML stuff and this data and parse it and present it and making sure that all the nodes lined up and,
Yeah, it's quite a hassle.
It is.
And the implementation of XQuery in the database is actually pretty good. The question is, do you really want to be doing it in the first place, you know? And so, and certainly as soon as you start dealing with complexities like, you know, XSI nil and nullable values, mm-hmm. and dealing with all the way they deal with embedded schemas and things and stuff. It's just like, yeah, there's a lot of complexity there. I have had places where I've used it. For example, if you were trying to pass a list of values into a procedure, for example, before we had table-valued parameters, mm-hmm. Then banging it into a little chunk of XML and then passing that, you know, sort of made sense.
Sure.
You know, you could do that. The biggest problem I found with that is that the nodes method that we often use to pull it apart, mm-hmm. Has no cardinality, and so it just guesses 10,000 every time. And
well, that doesn't need to be accurate, right? You know, it's just no.
And so you'd have some security thing where it's got like six roles or something being passed in, and then it assumes, writes the code as though there's 10,000 of them. And I remember one of the old MVPs back in those days pointing out that they could have got a better estimate by just going on the size of the XML. You know, I mean, if the XML is 200 bytes, it's probably not got 10,000 rows in there.
Probably
right?
not. Probably not.
So, yeah, there might have been better ways to come up with an estimate. But yeah. And, of course, the modern equivalent being JSON.
Yes.
And so much use of JSON as yet?
I have not. But I am dealing with some older systems. I haven't had anything like greenfield mm-hmm. since the JSON data type has come out where I could actually use it. But I think it's been implemented a little bit better than the XML, but I haven't played around enough to really definitively say that.
Yeah, I think the implementation that's there is actually very good, what's in there. And it's sort of interesting that that time they decided not to do a data type, where with XML we got an actual XML data type. But given the fact that UC has a public blog post talking about the upcoming JSON data type, I think we can mention the fact that that's being rectified,
yes.
along the way. But it introduces interesting things. Like even when XML came in, I don't know if people recall, but of course SQL XML appeared in 2003 as an add-on for 2000. And so you could execute a query that said select and you could say for XML. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was funky with that is that if you had a nested query that returned XML as one of the columns in that, the problem is we didn't have an XML data type. And so you had a query that would return XML, but there was no data type. And that's kind of funky when you've got a subquery, right? And so what happened there is that it would come back as an nvarchar max, basically. And so later when they added the XML data type, they had to add another word where you've got the type directive that said, I really meant XML. And of course, now we've got exactly the same thing with JSON, where you've got for JSON.
Yep.
And at the moment that returns a string, but we're going to have another word gets added that said, I actually want JSON back. Once we have a JSON data type.
Yeah, yeah.
So, no.
Do you think we're asking too ones... much? I think we might be asking.
No. what about graph things, nodes and edges and things?
So
did you get involved in those at all?
I have not played with those at all. Mm-hmm. I've attended a couple of sessions, and I've just not had a use case for that. Come up to be able to do anything more than just kind of play around with them. So I'm very curious because I know that it can solve a lot of problems, but right now for any of my clients, it doesn't solve anything for them. So.
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com.
Yeah, I didn't love it at all.
Yeah.
in terms of how it was implemented, I'm just not a fan of how it was done at all. And I think part of the problem is that sometimes there are things that we're trying to force into T-SQL, and T-SQL's not receptive to that.
Well, it's just not the best place for it.
Yeah, but see, even things like if I have a graph and I say, John is interested in a whole bunch of hobbies, and John likes these restaurants, and John likes these, sports or something like that, and then I want to run a query that says, give me back the things that John's interested in, that's a problem if some of the things are sports and some of the things are, and so on and so on and so on. It's like T-SQL's not designed to give you a result set back where you've got different types of objects in each row of the result set, those sorts of things. That's a challenge, And so the problem is graph databases tend to do that well, but when you get and you have to sort of slot that into T-SQL, I'm like, another thing I was talking to Davide about yesterday, and the thing I sent him is that, see, one of the things we can't build is we can't build functions that have dynamic data types. So, mm-hmm. for example, the new date-related functions, if you pass a date in, they give you a date back. But if you pass a date time 2 in, they give you a date time 2 back. We can't build a function that returns a different data type depending upon the input parameters, right?
No.
And so these are the sort of friction points when you're working with T-SQL as a wrapper,
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing where I've often thought one of the things I'd love to see them work on are things I think would really appeal to developers. Things like, say, table inheritance, where I could have an employee table and derive a salesperson table from the employee table, and so on and so on and so on,
mm-hmm.
and have the language understand that a salesperson is an employee, and I could write an employee query and run it against a salesperson and an employee, not just against an employee,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so on and so on, like the sort of polymorphism thing. But this is the sort of stuff you have to have to be able to play graph nicely, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm. And so, I don't know. So, I think that was a softball. That was a definite swing and a miss, that one. I don't know anybody using that, and I have a feeling it's just added a huge amount of technical baggage that has to be dealt with in upcoming versions every time something gets added.
For those five clients worldwide that actually used it, now they've got to support it from here to eternity.
I don't think that's been a great thing. Hey, but let's talk about dates and times, because that's a world of funkiness too. So what do you find people get right and wrong there?
So what I find there is that they don't understand the precision for each of those. Mm-hmm. So, and that goes back to my whole soapbox thing. You got to understand what your data domain is and how the data is going to be used. Because why store a date time if all you ever need is a date? That's just a waste of space. Mm-hmm. And then,
mind you, in their defense, there was a time that we didn't have a date.
Yeah, right? Fair enough.
So
fair
date
enough.
Time was the only option. Oh, well, that or small date time.
Yeah.
Again, I shudder every time I see that one.
Yeah. So.
Actually, one of the databases I came across, they had created an alias data type called date, and they'd mapped it to small date time. should see what happened when we tried to apply replication to that.
Oh, no.
It had no idea that they had redefined one of the data types that now existed.
Oh, man. Oh, that just sounds painful.
So beautiful.
Yeah. So I once had a guy, when I was talking, I was giving a session at a SQL Saturday about data types, and I was talking about, you know, date time too, and, you know, the precision mm-hmm. of it and all of that. And his response to me was, well, why would you ever use anything else but a date time too? That's just stupid. And I'm like, well, it depends on your use case.
Yep.
And you know what? There are some programming languages that don't actually recognize a date time to data type.
Yep.
So you need to understand how that data is going to be used once again.
Yeah, well, actually, that's an interesting thing, too, is that people don't stop and think. But one of the reasons for many years they had stopped adding data types as native data types is because of the downstream work that has to happen, mm-hmm. you know, to update the SQL client, the libraries, the, mm-hmm. you know, the .NET framework things. It just goes on and on and on, all the things that have to change when you add a native data type. And so I can get why things like a string for a JSON sort of made sense. You can slip it into the product without anywhere near the amount of work that would otherwise be required.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, look, I think overall, yeah, I think precision, particularly on date time, the fact that was 3 milliseconds is one of the things that throws people.
I've seen that so often. So you know, I've had developers come to me and say, you know, I needed to test, you know, just changing something. So I added 1 millisecond, but it still didn't change anything. And I said, you do realize...
That's
did
right.
you read the documentation?
Doesn't work like that.
It doesn't work.
The other one I've seen is the one where they try to pick a range of dates, and of course the end range is 0.999, and they don't realize that will round that up to the next day. You know? And so, yeah, these sorts of things, yeah, you have to understand. Yeah,
yeah, you really do.
What's going on with the data types you're using? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So many times that has happened where, you know, developers have come to me when they're testing their code. It doesn't work. And you know, and I'm like, well, what are you doing? And they tell me, and it's like, yeah, no, 3 milliseconds.
Actually, what about the one we didn't mention before with the exact numerics was the money and small money data types. Feelings there?
I avoid them at all costs.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that.
and I tell other people to avoid them too. I mean, if memory serves me, because I haven't used a money or a small money type mm-hmm. in probably more than a decade. But it's a lot like the floats, where aren't they just approximate values? You don't get the exact...
No, they're actually accurate, but they're a fixed 4 decimal places.
Okay.
Which is a funky thing, you know. And it's also a data type that understands currency symbols and things like that in strings when you do conversions and so on. It's a weird data type, that one. I'm endlessly disappointed to see it turn up in almost every Microsoft demonstration I see. Because I really don't want people using it.
Don't do that.
And it's just there all the time. And in fact, I was watching a Fabric demonstration yesterday, you know, and even in ADO.NET, they were using the parameters collection. They were using add with value. I used to spend my whole life pleading with developers to not use add with value because it doesn't have the data type, right? And yet there it is in all these sample code they're giving out to me. Please.
Yeah.
Really? And so, yeah, no, that's disappointing when I see that. Money you tend to avoid. And also, you know, decimal is just an ANC data type. I mean, you may as well go with it.
Well, yeah, because sometimes you need more accuracy and sometimes you need less accuracy. So why...
Mm-hmm.
Go with what it actually is and what you need.
And then we've got the SQL CLR based ones. And so hierarchy ID, any feeling there?
So, funny story with hierarchy ID. I was working on a project and, you know, they said, yeah, this is going to be great. It's going to solve everything. All these things that we've been trying to figure out. This is what it's going to do. And I said, I don't think it is, but go right ahead. You show me. You know, I felt like I say, you know, I'm from Missouri, the show me state. Show me that it's going to work. And then, you know, then we'll see. And sure enough, it didn't do anything that they wanted it to do.
Yeah, I don't like it at all. Right. I mean, there's a few of the functions and things that they've added in it that are kind of interesting, you know, like is descendant and some of those methods and things. But there's just too many things, because what they've done is they've tried to implement a tree, but they've implemented it from the point of view of one node. And the problem is that doesn't have visibility on the tree, right?
Yeah.
And so things like if I have a parent with a bunch of children and I move the parent, it just orphans all the children.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. Like, that is not what I would expect to see happen in a hierarchy,
no.
Right? These sorts of things. And it's interesting that when it first appeared, it was they were doing separate feature branches after all the problems that happened in 2005. But for that, in 2008, they had separate feature branches for these things. And the hierarchy ID was one of the things that appeared in CTP1, you know, the tech preview 1. And it was like they'd spun up the team, done the work, and then spun it down again. And they'd left like some poor guy there to do bug fixes. And then everybody looked at it in CTP1 and came back and basically said, you need to redesign this. Yeah. And the poor old soul who's just there to do bug fixes was like, And so what was interesting is it didn't change at all right through the CTP process. And it ended up going out the door the same as it was at CTP1, basically. And oh my goodness.
You know, yeah. Like, not
everybody was just saying, don't use this,
yeah, don't,
you know,
do
like
that.
Right up front. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's another one just seemed to be a wasted effort, that one. But also in that, we got SQL geometry and geography, which I actually think the SQL spatial stuff was staggeringly good. But I don't know if you've had a chance to use that or not.
So I haven't. I've used the geography a little bit, you know, computing distances and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. But I haven't had a chance to use the geometry. Yeah. I've seen it done and I've seen people do things with it. But again, I've never had a use case in any of the things that I've done for any of my clients.
We actually have an online course on Spatial at our site, and there's still people do that, you know, every week. I mean, there's still people pop in and do that. I actually thought it was, in 2008, they did fabulous work on it, the underlying work. 2012, they did really, really good work over the top of it. And then it's one of these things again that they just basically haven't touched since, you know, tiny, tiny things since, but I mean, they really haven't touched it. And I always think it's such a pity, you know, they do such great work and then they just sort of almost like abandon it, you know, and,
well, I think
a big part is they just don't even talk about it. So I was thinking yesterday, you know, have I seen a Microsoft session talking about Spatial in the last decade?
Probably
and
not.
I can't recall one, right?
Mm-mm.
And that's incredibly sad. And it's because it's not flavor of the month.
No. You know, at the moment. Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. It's not the new shiny, so it doesn't get any love to get enhanced anything.
But if you go to a room of devs and you show them what it can do, they're like in awe. And I think this is interesting too, is that a lot of these features, we got to a point after about 2012 where the Microsoft team were more talking to just DBAs and not the developer teams. And what would happen is you talk to someone who's working in a production DBA role or something and say, you know, here's Service Broker or here's, mm-hmm. you know, the spatial stuff and think. Yeah, the problem is you're talking to entirely the wrong audience.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've got to be talking
stuff.
To the... No, that's it. And so, and if you ask them what they need, they're never going to say any of those words,
no.
right?
No.
It's a transacted queue in the database. Why would I want that? Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, if you talk to the dev team leads who are building the products, or designing the products, they're interested.
Absolutely, you know? But, yeah, yeah.
And you got to talk to them. But anyway, but yeah, look, I was super pleased with what they did in Spatial. And yeah, it's just amazing what is there.
Yeah,
and
the stuff
it's
that I
amazing.
Can do
was, they're not was, they don't talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, it was perfect for what I was doing, and I was like, this made it so much easier than how we used to have to do things before. So,
What about converting data types? Anything around, you know, cast, convert, any of those things?
So I'm super glad that they gave us tri-cast and tri-convert instead of
yes.
just airing out with convert and cast. But what I find is that people still don't understand that even though it's not airing out, you still might not get the right answer when you're trying
That's
to
right.
convert something. So that's kind of one of the pitfalls that I have seen with that. Even though we no longer air out, people just aren't educated enough to understand what it means.
Hmm.
And so that's something that I always try to, you know, inform people about, educate people on, is that,
yeah,
we no longer get an error, but look at our result sets. We're still not getting the right answer.
Actually, in T-SQL classes, what I tell people to use it for all the time is I try now to get them to never use isNumeric, isDate,
nope.
any of those functions. Because, like, isNumeric, have you ever tested what that actually will return
oh.
and say isNumeric?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you have to be kidding, right?
Yeah.
And so in every time you feel yourself compelled to write isNumeric, you need to go... you know, try cast this as whatever specific data type I want, you know, is null.
Yeah.
or is not null. You know, then you know. And it's so beautiful because now we can test for specific data types.
Yes. Yeah.
Not just these funkiness, you know, like is date and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No longer, you know, so I don't think I've ever used isNumeric because mm-hmm. because it returns all kinds of stuff. So I've always had just this little tiny piece of code that I have sitting out in my source control, you know, repository, whatever you want to call it, for checking if all of the characters are numbers, you know, and it's essentially kind of like a regular expression checker to check for that. And that's what I have used my entire career as opposed to isNumeric, because it
yep.
isNumeric doesn't work.
See, now... try convert, try parse, and yeah, try cast. Just wonderful additions
yes.
to the language.
Yes.
And they do that really, really well. There's also SQL variant, which is
a blast from the past.
Yeah, and all it's still around.
Is it still
right?
around?
I mean, it's very much still around. Yeah, and so this is a data type where you're able, in theory, to store data of any type.
Oh.
And, of course, where that actually works really well is if you're building utilities that have to store things without knowing what type they are and so on and so on. And so it's kind of like second-level stuff, you know, where that makes sense. The problem I find with it is there's just a bunch of bugs in it. Like some of the stuff... Yeah, for example, I think date time 2, for example, I think if you try and cast it as a SQL variant, that used to blow up.
Oh.
Or maybe with an offset, you know, it was like, yeah, one of those anyway, the date ones just didn't quite work, you
Oops.
Know, and so on. And so, yeah, that's a bit of a problem. And hopefully that's sort of getting all fixed up. And of course, then we had the older data types, the image, text, end text, stuff like that. Do you still see a lot of those around?
Not too much, actually. Surprisingly, I probably haven't seen text or image in at least 10 years, honestly. Which makes me happy because then I don't have to.
I was going to say, that's lucky. I still see it all the time.
It makes my life easier, so I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I think the only learning I've had with that, of course, is that the default for the old types was they were stored out of row, and the default for the new types is they're stored in the row, and then they use overflow pages if they need to. And so one of the problems is if you just convert the data type with, you know, alter table, alter column, and change the data type to one of the new ones, it still is stored out of row, even if it would have fitted in the row, you know, and so on. And so you've literally got to rebuild the table to lob compaction and all that sort of stuff to try and sort of get that to now work again properly.
Yeah, and that might be a problem if you have tables that have billions of records in them. So
precisely.
I don't know.
Yeah, and look, they're probably the main ones, you know. In addition to that, I mean, there's obviously var binary, and I mean, you know, we can store all sorts of things in that. That's been a good catch-all. The only other one I wish was in there, straight off the top of my head, is I do wish we had constants. That's something that I've missed in SQL Server. And one of the problems with this is, so for example, if I create a procedure and at the beginning of the procedure I say declare some variable and then equals some value, then the fact that it's a variable doesn't guarantee that it's a constant for a start. It could get modified somewhere along the way. But the bigger issue is at the point it compiles the procedure, it doesn't know the value. And I think if we actually had constants, then the compiler could know.
It could make better decisions.
It could make much better decisions. And so I'd love to see constants where we could define them probably at the, you know, in a proc could be okay, but at the database level would probably be the logical level. You know, if I could define a bunch of values that, And then IntelliSense would work, you know, with the constants and so on. A category of that would be to have enumerations in there as well. So, you know, if there are six values for something, you know, just being able to define the enumeration so that, you know, when we go, I hate seeing code, you know, in a proc that says where sum equals two, and you think, what's that two? You know, or three or something. And there's no comment to tell you, you know, like, what on earth that thing means. Yeah. And it's just that, three means something, you know, it's like a parameter to a procedure that you don't know what it is or something. I mean, all those things could become constants, you know, and so on. And I just think it would improve the readability of the code no end if you could actually use what the thing is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
rather than a number.
Yeah,
Something like that.
I've not thought of that. That's really good. I like that. That's a good use.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I just sort of take for granted in higher level programming languages. And I just wish were there, you know.
Yeah.
And so, hey, listen, that pretty much brings us to time though, Angela. Okay. But listen, where will people see you? What you got coming up? Anything happening?
So I will be at Data Grillin' in May. So I'm very excited about that. It's been a hot minute since I've been there, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Which city is that?
That's in Lingen, which is a really tiny town kind of north and west of Dusseldorf. North and east of Dusseldorf, west of Dusseldorf. I think it's west of Dusseldorf. It's about a 2-hour
long drive. Time since I've been to Dusseldorf. Yeah. There was a PASS conference there once.
Yeah.
You know, like a long, long time ago.
A very long time ago. Yes. back when they would move that around the continents.
Yeah, well, there was the past European conferences, yep. Yeah, that mm-hmm. yeah appeared in different places, and Dusseldorf was one of those. Yeah.
So that's where I'm at next. I haven't really. I've submitted to some others. Those haven't gone anywhere yet. They're still in the submission process. So I'm not sure if I'll go to Seattle or Florida this fall. Mm-hmm. I went to Florida last fall, and I like that a lot better than the Seattle weather in the fall. So it's a little bit warmer. And it's much closer for me. It's only 2 hours in an airplane as opposed to 10 hours of travel for the entire day to get to Seattle for me. So,
well, yeah, I'm used to very, very long
travel. Yeah, look who I'm talking to and complaining about travel. So yeah,
I vividly remember one day when I caught a flight, and we went from... was Sydney to Melbourne, which is the wrong direction to start with. And then we flew from, Melbourne to Singapore, and then Singapore to London, and then London to Paris.
Oh, my God.
And then Paris to somewhere else. You know, it was like, and that was like one set of flights. Oh. I'm like, oh, my goodness. You know, it was like a vegetable at the other end.
Yeah, that's, oh, so man. Bad.
One of the things I discovered while doing a lot of that travel at the time is I had no idea there was a limit on the number of flights you could have on a single electronic ticket.
Oh.
It was 18 was the number. So who knew, you know?
I bet that's a data type issue on the back end.
No, you know what I reckon it is? Is I remember the old paper tickets, I think, had six lines on each mm-hmm. one, and you could probably have three pages.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and I'll bet you, like, the old Galileo system or whatever mm-hmm. in the back end has still got that same COBOL yep. stuff that you know, yeah. And so no matter what you stick in front of it, you know, at the back end.
Yeah, that's right.
It's, you know, it's still hard-coded 18, you know, like, yeah, who would ever have, yeah. And so, it's just the industry we're in.
Yeah.
So anyway, so listen, it was so good to talk to you today.
It was very good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for...
Absolutely.
Taking part.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Thanks.